It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson's here. We're going to talk about 1.1.1.1, Steve's DNS benchmark, and which DNS servers are the fastest to use. He's also got a review of the encrypted email system from Switzerland, Proton Mail. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 657, recorded April 3rd, 2018, Proton Mail. Security Now is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/securitynow. And by FreshBooks. Join over 10 million people using FreshBooks to painlessly send invoices, track time, and capture expenses. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/securitynow. And by IT Pro TV. Flexible and entertaining training for your IT career. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and privacy online as we have done for more than a decade. Wow.
My God.
And
we're in our 12th year, in fact.
Yep. It's all thanks to this guy right here, Mr. Steve Gibson of GRC.com. Hi, Steve.
You know, for the first time ever, I'm able to do my wave salute without worrying about bumping into the microphone.
You switched sides.
Because I am, well, so to speak, because the landscapers decided now would be a great time to grind up some trees.
Oh, man.
And so I listened to it. They went away for a while, and I thought, oh, maybe they're done. But I think that was just lunch break. Ugh. And they're back with a vengeance. So the microphone is so directional that I thought, okay, fine. It's a pain in the butt to move it over. But on the other hand, I can now do my salute without having to bump the microphone.
Yeah, I don't hear a thing. So
yeah,
good job. Great.
So Proton Mail came up a couple times. First of all, a lot of our listeners are wondering about secure email. Now, I've always regarded that phrase as an inherent oxymoron. And so I've never really just focused on it much, but I know it's what people want. And a question from a listener reminded me of that question. It was about, if I were to leave Google, where would I go? You know, leave Gmail. And then, coincidentally, Proton Mail announced an upgrade to their mobile clients. And I thought, okay, fine. Let's talk about what they've done. Because they've arguably done the best job they can, given the inherent limitations of email. And they're 1,000 meters below solid rock in Switzerland, so that's a story we have to tell.
That's the kind of thing, though, that you often would mock, right? Like,
yeah,
that doesn't have anything to do with security.
Yeah, the backhoe can still cut the fibers, and
exactly.
But we're going to talk about a bunch of things before we get to talk about Proton Mail. We have now the information that was pending last week on what has been named Drupalgeddon 2, as you know, Armageddon, Drupalgeddon, which arrived the day after last week's podcast. So we have the information about that. We have a very interesting and I think significant new DNS offering from the oft-mentioned Cloudflare people, who are just doing a bang-up job with all kinds of stuff. I mean, they're really making a name for themselves. And GRC's own DNS benchmark confirms their claims. So later down in the show notes is a screenshot that of my just having run GRC's benchmark, and I'm going to show people who may – well, actually, it's pretty simple, but you know, there's a button you press if you want to add DNS servers to the benchmark. So people are going to want to add 1.1.1.1 and not so much 1.0.0.1. We'll talk about that. Then we got to talk about Microsoft's meltdown, the persistent iOS QR code scanner flaw that persisted even across the much anticipated version 11.3 update to iOS, which fixed a bunch of things. There's another VPN user IP leak. Some more bug bounty news, which is kind of interesting in a different direction. A very ill-fated seeming new email initiative that we need to talk about just because it may kind of be coming to a client near you. The consequences of free electricity, a policy change at Google's Chrome store, another please change your passwords after another website breach, a bit of miscellany, a heartwarming SpinRite report, some closing the loop feedback from our terrific listeners, and then we're going to talk about, brought to you from Switzerland, an encrypted email service that may be worth looking at if you're, you know, if Gmail is chafing for one reason or another. Although I made a comment last week about them looking and like reading everyone's email, and on a different podcast, I realized, oh, that's old news.
Yeah, I heard you say that on Know How, and I meant to tell you that.
Ah,
yeah.
That's where it was. Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah, they stopped doing that. Not that they're not spying on you, and
not that there still might not be a reason to increase your security.
Yeah. And your ISP's spying on you for sure, and et cetera.
Yep.
All right, I can't wait. Actually, I've been looking at Proton Mail. You know, my strong preference is just if I want security mail to use PGP or GNU Privacy Guard and encrypt the mail, and that way I don't have to worry. But metadata leaks. And as we know, metadata is valuable too.
Yep.
So good. I look forward to this. Our show, real briefly, just before you really get going, let me mention a word from our sponsor, as they used to say. Our show today brought to you by the best lender in the nation. For home mortgages, it's Quicken Loans, no question about it. Not only the biggest in terms of volume, the best in terms of customer satisfaction. Number one, 8 years in a row, almost as long as we've been doing this show, according to J.D. Power. For customer satisfaction, for mortgage approval process, mortgage origination. Also, I think the last 4 or 5 years for mortgage servicing, they're really good. And they're very technically savvy. The team over there at Quicken Loans, they're all geeks anyway. And I think that one of the things they understand that geeks want, we don't want to go to a bank to get a home loan. We don't want to go through that process, which is so 19th century, you know, the whole going through the list of rates and things like that. It should all be computerized. It should all be automatic. Frankly, it should all be online. And now, thanks to Quicken Loans, it is with Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage, entirely online loan approval process. Now, I have to say that thanks to antiquated banking and financial laws, when you get the loan, you still have to sign papers. But here's the beauty part. They actually come to you. A notary comes to you with all the papers and you sign it at your house. So even then, you don't have to leave home. But you'll love the mortgage approval process. So fast, so easy that you can really literally do it at an open house. You could say, I want to make an offer. Let's get a loan approval. And 8 minutes later, show the realtor. We're ready. We want to make an offer. So here's the deal. You go to rocketmortgage.com/security now. You'll be entering in a few. There is an application, but it's not the 20-page application that a bank will offer you. You just answer a few simple questions that you know the answer to: name, address, phone number, date of birth, social, that kind of thing. They have trusted relationships with all the financial institutions, so they, with your permission, they can get all the information they need. You don't have to go to the attic and search for old pay stubs or old bank statements. Quicken Loans does it all with Rocket Mortgage. It's very simple. You'll know all the details of the loan and the process. It's very transparent. You choose the rate, you choose the term, you choose the down payment. They crunch the numbers based on income, assets, and credits. They'll analyze all the home loan options for which you qualify, and they find the one that's right for you, and then you're done. You're approved. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. And that's 8 minutes, tops. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently with Rocket Mortgage. Go to rocketmortgage.com/security now. Actually, if you go there now, you can set it up so it'll take even less time. You'll be all ready to go. They do refis too. Rocket, there's a good time to do it. rocketmortgage.com/security now. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. rocketmortgage.com/security now. We thank Quicken Loans for their support. I have a picture.
So our picture of the week, having just jumped up and down and congratulated Cloudflare, I don't know where they get these numbers. So
Fred Flintstone, obviously.
Yeah. So they're showing 1.1.1.1.
That's their new service, which they launched on April Fool's Day, which confused everybody.
It did, especially because it's 4.1 and it's 4.1s.
Well, that's what CEO Matthew Prince said. This is exactly the perfect time to launch it on 4.1, right?
Yeah.
Even though.
So the good news is it's not a joke. However, okay, they're showing 14.8 milliseconds for their DNS lookup. They're showing OpenDNS at 20.6, Google's public DNS at 34.7, and the average ISP, and I don't know what ISP is it? Is it 68.23? We'll get to this in a minute, but you know, I have to say I'm really sort of tickled that if you Google for the term DNS benchmark and look at images, it's just a screen full of screenshots of GRC's benchmark. So I ran it a few minutes ago in order to make a screenshot for the show notes. And my ISP, right, that makes sense, is the closest DNS server to me. I mean, any package going to any other DNS server have to go by my ISP first, sort of by definition. Well, it was 8 milliseconds for four of my Cox servers. Cox is my ISP here in Southern California. 1.1.1.1, to their credit, and I fully intend to give them credit, was 1 millisecond longer. It was the fastest non-Cox DNS server of all. I mean, and I've got OpenDNS and I've got Google Public DNS and a whole bunch of other ones are in there. So, I mean, it is absolutely the fastest alternative to any DNS server that's not your ISP's. But I don't know whose ISP takes 68 milliseconds to respond. You know, I just can't explain that. But, you know, not mine. So the good news is for Windows users, and it runs under Wine, I think, too. So non-Windows users who have access to Wine should be able to run GRC's DNS benchmark and test this themselves. And I would suggest everyone does because, you know, in my case, the performance penalty it is measurable, but it is arguably not worth sacrificing the benefits, which we will be talking about when we talk about Cloudflare's offering. So anyway, just the picture of the week was what is being plastered everywhere. And it's like, okay. The good news is no one has to believe this bar chart with numbers that are strange. I mean, Google's public DNS wasn't that much slower, nor was OpenDNS. They were slower, but not like, ouch. So anyway, people can find out for themselves, and everyone should, because, you know, your mileage will vary. And boy, if your ISP is taking 68 milliseconds to respond to a single UDP packet, you know, if you have any choice, you might consider what else they're slow at. So, okay, last Wednesday, the big news that had a week's notice given landed, which was there is a very bad remote code execution vulnerability in Drupal that dates all the way back to version 6.x branch, which was discontinued more than 2 years ago. So this is so bad, and apparently there are still people still using something on the 6.x branch, that they offered updates even back there. So that suggests that this is has been a very long-standing problem. And the other thing that suggests, unfortunately, is that there are going to be a lot of problems with Drupal sites that are not getting their email, that are not patching themselves, that have just been set up and, you know, by some techie who wandered off, and people are using the site and don't realize that they're now a target because they can be found. After the patches were announced, Drupal took their own site down after the release of the updates so that it too could be updated. They didn't want to do it beforehand, much as they may have wished to, because it may have been possible for people to figure out what was going on. And of course, this is the problem, is that hackers are, this is a big target. As we know, they're the number two content management platform on the internet with a ton of installations. So Drupalgeddon 1 was a super severe bug. It was rated 25 out of 25. It was an SQL injection bug in 2014. So nothing really that bad has happened until now, thus giving this one Drupalgeddon 2's name. It's an input validation issue where invalid query parameters can be passed into Drupal web pages. No proof of concept code was released because, of course, this isn't some third party that found it. The bug was found by Drupal's own security people, a guy named Greg Nadison, who's a security team member, found it and explained that it has to do with the way Drupal interprets a value that begins with a hash as having a special meaning. And so, they're trying to promote the idea that they're working, of course, to downplay the severity of this, saying that hundreds of thousands of sites immediately patched within the first 12 hours of the release. On the other hand, an independent firm, SiteLock, did some measurements of their own and determined that only 18% of Drupal websites were found to be running the latest core updates. So this suggests that, as we keep seeing with these kinds of problems, the vast majority of websites running Drupal are likely to be vulnerable to compromise because they're not being updated with the latest security patches. So I'm glad that everybody listening to this podcast knows, and if you have any influence over local Drupal sites that you immediately updated. We know, Leo, that your Twit engineers were on top of it from the get-go.
Yep.
And
got
no
both
doubt.
Both sites patched like at noon, nice. Right after the patch came out. Yeah.
Nice. So I'm afraid that we will be covering, exploitation of servers. And we know what's going to happen. They're not going to dig into anyone's network. They're just going to set up crypto miners. Because that's the thing now. Everyone wants to run, cryptocurrency mining on servers. And I wouldn't be surprised if the hackers are rubbing their hands together, say, because I think there are about 1 million Drupal sites. So they're probably rubbing their hands together saying, hey, there may be some like 750,000 servers available for exploitation if we can find them. And unfortunately, as a company like SiteLock demonstrates, it's easy to determine if a site is Drupal-based based on the response to queries from the web. So I'm afraid we're going to be covering the downside of this. Okay, so Cloudflare. IP is wonderful, of course. 1.1.1.1. Hard to forget that one. They also offer 1.0.0.1, but everyone should take note that that is significantly slower. It's meant to be a backup, and so you want to do, you want to make sure 1.0.0.1 is your secondary DNS IP, and at the moment you might even consider using your own ISP's DNS servers as backup with 1.1.1 as your primary. So the and the logic that IP resolvers use is to first try the primary resolver that you've registered. In this case, it'd be 1.1.1.1. And if it fails, typically then the rest of them that are set up as backups are simultaneously queried to if the primary doesn't respond. The DNS benchmark, GRC's DNS benchmark, also verifies reliability, and there wasn't a single query missed in the, I've forgotten now how many I do, probably 100. Reliability was right up there. But so the news is, and we've sort of been stepping all over it already, is that Cloudflare has decided that they want to jump into the sort of the growing DNS provider space. We've talked about others that have. Of course, Google is. OpenDNS has been there, and Cisco purchased OpenDNS. And we actually talked about this before the Cloudflare announcement in the context of Mozilla last week, because remember that I was talking about how the next version of Firefox, we're at 59 right now. When we get to 60, Firefox will be with like beta testing their connection with Cloudflare as the de facto DOH DNS over HTTPS. And this is exciting because this gives us security and privacy for DNS and probably no more speed than we get with UDP, because you just can't get any faster than a single packet being sent and a packet coming back. TCP has to do the same thing. However, DNS is not encrypted and is not authenticated. And so if we run DNS with the same single packet query inside of a TLS encrypted and authenticated tunnel to a provider, then we get all of the benefits and no reduction in performance. So Cloudflare at this IP 1.1.1.1, and anybody who's interested can actually go to that domain with the web browser, https://1.1.1.1. Put that IP in, and that will resolve to their announcement and configuration and setup instructions. And so it's meant to be user-friendly. So you can actually put https://1.1.1.1 into your web browser and go take a look at the service. So they are they have, as I mentioned, two resolver IPs. That one, the quad one, and also 1.0.0.1, which when you put both of those in and you add those to GRC's DNS benchmark, it automatically gets the IPs that are configured for your system, presumably from your ISP or OpenDNS or whatever provider. So it adds those to its large list of DNS servers. You can then manually add these, and I'm thinking it's probably time for me to rev the software. I haven't touched it in 8 years because, you know, it works. There's no bugs. So maybe it's time to add 1.1.1.1 and 1.0.0.1 just to have them built in. But anyway, Olafur Gudmundsson, who's the director of engineering at Cloudflare, said of this effort, "Our goals with the public resolver are simple. Cloudflare wants to operate the fastest public resolver on the planet while raising the standard of privacy protections for users." And I can assert that, yes, theirs is faster than any other non-ISP resolver in my own testing. And I did this several times over the course of the last several days. He said, "We began talking with browser manufacturers about what they would want from a DNS resolver. One word kept coming up: privacy. Beyond just a commitment not to use browser data to help target ads, they wanted to make sure we would wipe all transaction logs within a week. That was an easy request. In fact, we knew we could go much further. We committed to never writing the query IP address to disk and to wiping all logs within 24 hours. He says, "The DNS resolver 1.1.1.1 is also supporting privacy-enabled TLS queries on port 853, which is the service's DNS over TLS. So we can keep queries hidden from snooping networks. Furthermore, by offering the experimental DOH, DNS over HTTPS protocol, we improve upon privacy and a number of future speedups for end users, as browsers and other applications can now mix DNS and HTTPS traffic into one single connection." Okay, now I have no idea what that means. It's like, what? That needs to be clarified, because I don't see how establishing a single connection to port 853, which is DNS over TLS, allows you to pipeline non-DNS traffic. So maybe they've got something more up their sleeve that isn't apparent. He says also, "With aggressive negative caching," and I'll explain that in a second, "as described in RFC 8198, we can further decrease the load on the global DNS system." Negative caching is the process of remembering DNS query failures in addition to DNS query successes. So it's obvious that DNS caching says, oh, look, here's something that people are asking for. Let's keep it locally in our cache after having resolved it once through what may have been a recursive DNS lookup. And as we know, DNS queries have an expiration as part of them. So that permits someone who receives it fresh from the authoritative server to hold it in their cache until its own self-stated expiration times out, in which case they need to go get it again. Well, negative caching says, someone asked us for a domain name that doesn't exist. We looked for it, couldn't find it. So let's also remember that. That's negative caching, where you cache a negative outcome of a search, again, just to speed up the return of an NX domain, which says, sorry, that doesn't exist. And that's, I'm sure that Cloudflare would never consider taking us to some advertising page, but they do properly return an NX domain. We'll note that some ISP DNS doesn't. That is, ISPs often use a failed lookup to take you to their own search page, where they do a little marketing. So, which really breaks the definition of DNS and has been some controversial in the past. So he says, this technique first tries to use the existing resolver's negative cache, which keeps negative, non-existent information around for a period of time. He says, for zones signed with DNSSEC, and that's another thing that they are supporting, which is very cool. I'll get to in a second. And from the NSEC records in cache, the resolver can figure out if the requested name does not exist without doing any further querying. He also says, we use DNSSEC validation when possible, as that allows us to be sure the answers are accurate and untampered with. The cost of signature verifications is low, and the potential savings we get from aggressive negative caching more than make up for that. We want our users to trust the answers we give out, and thus perform all possible checks to avoid giving bad answers to the clients. He says, however, DNSSEC is very unforgiving. Errors in DNSSEC configuration by authoritative DNS operators can make such misconfigured domains unresolvable. To work around this problem, Cloudflare will configure negative trust anchors on domains with detected and vetted DNSSEC errors and remove them once the configuration is rectified by the authoritative operators. This limits the impact of broken DNSSEC domains by temporarily disabling DNSSEC validation for a specific misconfigured domain, restoring access to end consumers. So essentially what this means is they're doing all of the work and heavy lifting for us. Remember that for the time being, until browsers start doing DNS over TLS, we're using UDP. So we have an unsecured, non-authenticated query that we're making if you were to configure to 1.1.1.1 to Cloudflare. But with Firefox 60, and I meant to go look at Chrome to see whether Chrome can already have this turned on, because certainly Google is offering this service, as I mentioned last week. But so I want to make it clear that at the moment, some configuration is required in order to switch from UDP to TLS. When you do that, then you are establishing an authenticated TLS connection to the DNS provider, in this case, Cloudflare. So your queries are encrypted, you get privacy, you get the authentication of TLS, and Cloudflare is a DNSSEC aware resolver. So to the degree that domains are signed, then they'll verify the signatures, making sure that what they're getting is not spoofed. And because you've got TLS for the so-called last mile, your query to them, that's both private and unspoofable. So this is sort of a nice and unsuspected compromise on requiring all endpoints like us to do DNSSEC ourselves, at least for our browsers, and not yet for our operating systems, but that may be coming. But our browsers can be smart enough to do their own resolution through an encrypted tunnel and really tighten up the DNS system, which, as we know, is, as I said last week, is still sort of the one thing hanging out there. In the show notes here, I have a screenshot of my having run the DNS benchmark around 8:30 this morning. And the first four entries are for Cox Communications. And sure enough, they are the four fastest resolvers. The fifth entry says Megapath Networks, Inc., and it shows the IP 1.1.1.1. So if anyone is interested, If you just Google DNS benchmark, the first handful of links are to GRC. When you run the benchmark, since it isn't yet, because it's I haven't touched the code in 8 years, since 2010 is when I finished the work on that. When you run the benchmark, you'll need to add 1.1.1.1 and 1.0.0.1 to the existing list of DNS resolvers. Well, on the name servers tab, is in the upper left is an add remove button for adding and removing name servers. And it's so it's as simple as clicking that. Up pops a dialog that prompts you for the IPs of resolvers you want to add or remove, and you can do so right there. So add 1.1.1.1, 1.0.0.1, and then just click Run Benchmark, and it'll start spinning and showing you results. And what was interesting is, first of all, it's not clear, but here's an insider tip. You can left-click in the bar chart, and it will show you actual numerical results. I don't remember whether you can do it while it's running. You probably can. Everything works. I put a lot of time into this benchmark. But certainly when it's done, you can left-click on the bars and then cruise around, and a little floater that tracks where you left click will show you the actual timings of all of those. That's how I know that the first four, the Cox Communications resolvers, were all responding in 8 milliseconds, and the next fastest one was 9 milliseconds. What's interesting is that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 entries down below Quad 9, below Google, both of Google's resolvers, below the OpenDNS resolvers, below DSL Extreme and a couple stray Cox communications resolvers, like way further down the list is 1.0.0.1. So that one is, it's still quick. It's nothing like 68 milliseconds. I don't know where they got that, but it is a few milliseconds slower, and definitely slower than a whole bunch of others that we're familiar with, the open DNS resolvers, Googles, and so forth. So 1.1.1.1 is absolutely, for me, next fastest from all of my ISP's resolvers. But 1.0.0.1 is well down the list, which, you know, I imagine you're going to want to see for yourself. And the DNS benchmark allows you to get those results. And if you poke around in the UI, there's all kinds of other little goodies in the DNS benchmark. Okay, one more story, and then we'll take our second break. The Windows Meltdown patch. A Swedish security researcher, Ulf Frisk, ULF Frisk, who is also the developer of a tool known as PCI Leech, which is a kernel memory hacking tool that you can find on GitHub, discovered that Microsoft's January, that is the beginning of the year, 2018 patch for the Meltdown fix for Windows 7 64-bit. That's all. The 64-bit version of Windows 7, not 8.1, not Windows 10, just that one, mistakenly flipped a permission bit in the page table management. It was supposed to be set to supervisor mode only. Somehow it got flipped to user mode. As a consequence of the work he was doing on his PCI Leech tool, he quickly discovered that until last Friday, so end of March, so January, February, March, for 3 months, Windows 7 64-bit memory, all of it, was completely readable and writable to all user mode applications. Whoops. So Microsoft quickly added, pushed out an out-of-cycle emergency update late last week to flip this wayward kernel memory access control permission bit back where it was supposed to be. The flaw was not remotely exploitable. It was just about internal OS memory management. So any attacker would have needed, first of all, to know about it, and then to have physical access and or some malware installed. But it was devastating because, it's like it completely blew away all of the OS protection, essentially making absolutely all of the system's virtual memory readable and writable to any user mode program running on that system. So you want to make sure, now that I've said this and now that everybody knows about this, this is like instantaneously exploitable. So if you're running Windows 7 64, and of course that also is the server, and that's of course Service Pack 1 and Server 2008 R2, which is the same OS basically. The server stuff is enabled in it. You want to absolutely make sure that you're all patched up to date, which will then include KB 4100 480. If you're curious, go into updates and just make sure that you're seeing KB 4100 480 has been installed, and then you know you're okay. Now, you can also test it if you're interested. If you just Google PCI Leech, L-E-E-C-H, you'll get taken to Olaf's page over on GitHub, where you can play with this tool he's got. He warns that there's some instability may be created in the system, which could blue screen in the case of your system being vulnerable. So save everything first. And if you're interested, you can run PCI Leech just to verify that system is in fact not vulnerable. And I would not recommend anyone do that on a live server because, you could take it down by mistake. So anyway, for 3 months, all of Windows 7 64-bit OS memory was readable, writable by all applications running on the system. That got fixed late last week.
Steve, it's time to mention a fine sponsor that saved my bacon many moons ago. Back in the old days when I used to go up to Toronto and do call for help up there, I had a situation.
And eat bacon, probably.
And eat bacon. Canadian bacon. Right. The fine back bacon Canada is so famous for. That was all good. I enjoyed that. But, I had expenses because I had air travel and hotel and bacon. And then, of course, I had to bill them and all that stuff. And it was Rogers, and I had to bill them in Canadian dollars. And I hated it. Fire up Word and Excel and all that. It was just painful. Often to the point where I just wouldn't bill them, where I learned a valuable lesson that every freelancer should learn. If you don't invoice, you don't get paid. Fortunately, thanks to Amber MacArthur, I found FreshBooks, a little Canadian startup back in 2004. Now, the way to do invoicing. In fact, you've probably heard about us talking about FreshBooks. 10 million users now. They use FreshBooks to painlessly send invoices, to track billable hours, to capture expenses. And when you do all of that, you're also doing your bookkeeping. It really is cloud accounting software for small business owners. You'll love the intuitive dashboard, which gives you access to your spending, your outstanding balances, something freelancers rarely know, total profit, and other accounting reports. So you'll know how you're doing at any given moment. And by the way, when tax season comes, I know it's just around the corner, but next year you'll be thrilled you've been using FreshBooks. It also automatically connects to your bank account and updates expenses daily. So it's not even a lot of data entry on your part. Now, let's get to the invoices, because that's the heart and soul of it. Professional-looking invoices, you design in seconds, you send via email. They save you time and they get you paid faster because they all have a pay button. As soon as you start using FreshBooks, you can automatically accept credit card payments directly from the invoice, which means you get paid on average twice as fast. See what invoices have been sent, which have been paid, which are unpaid, and even which have been viewed. You'll understand if you're a freelancer why it's important to know that your client has viewed the invoice but not yet paid it. You can create proposals. This is, they're always adding features because it's a web app. The latest one was this proposal thing with rich text content and images and customizable sections. FreshBooks really is all about helping the small business and the freelancer get the job done. You could bill for time by client, but even by specific projects, so you can have different billable hours. They are now in Spanish, Dutch, German, and Portuguese as options for invoices, estimates, and proposals. They've always had multi-currency support, multilingual support. And then there's the FreshBooks app, which makes it easy to stay connected to your clients, keep tabs on your business as you move around, take a picture of a receipt, upload it, let FreshBooks do the rest. You can have separate rates for different team members. There's a My Team page. You can add new team members like business partners, basic employee, or contractor, depending on which permissions you want to grant each team member in the FreshBooks dashboard. Payment reminders, late fees, all automatable, as much or as little as you want. FreshBooks is awesome. Look, I'm wasting your time. Just go right now to FreshBooks.com/security now and enter security now in the How Did You Hear About Us section. You could try it free for 30 days. FreshBooks.com/security now. We thank them for their support of Steve and the Security Now program and for saving my Canadian bacon many moons ago.
So, speaking of bugs and patches, there is a much covered iOS flaw in the QR code scanner, which was added to the normal built-in iOS camera app. It's kind of a neat thing that we got with the jump to iOS 11, such that just using the camera app, rather than needing a third-party QR code scanning app, if the camera sees a chunk of real estate which parses out to be a valid QR code, it says, oh, there's a QR code, and drops a little message down on the screen saying, you know, tap to go to this site. Well, just before Christmas, on December 23rd of 2017, so just over 3 months ago, it came to a German security researcher's attention, a guy by the name of Roman Mueller, that there was a way to spoof these URLs. That is, you could create a QR code which showed one domain name on the screen, but took you to a different domain name, which is not good. And 90 days later, this problem is still unpatched. So Roman published his findings. He gave Apple 3 months to fix this. And I tried it yesterday on my newly updated version 11.3, and it still works. That is, it's still broken. Using a URL that is present in a lot of the coverage of this online, so anybody can find it, and I have the URL here in the show notes. When you scan this sample QR code, it says you're going to be going to Facebook.com, clear as it could be. And when you tap it, it takes you to infosec.rm-it.de, which is Roman's demo page, saying, nope. Now, the problem, of course, is this could be a malicious page spoofing Facebook, and no one would be the wiser. So I'm at a complete loss to understand how Apple could have let this be out there for 90 days. Roman kept quiet. He let everybody know after 90 days. And if you Google iOS QR code bug, there's a huge amount of coverage in the press. So let's hope that this shines a spotlight on it, that apparently I can't imagine what Apple is thinking, that they haven't fixed this. You know, this is a bad problem. And essentially it means that that something is parsing the QR code to get this full URL, but the code that displays where you're going to go is different than the code which takes you there. So I can't understand how Apple has not fixed this, but they haven't, and now the world knows about it. So now it can start getting exploited. So because there's no mystery anymore, this is trivial to do, and I wouldn't be surprised if bad guys are not thinking, you know, how can we fool iOS users with this? So let's hope that Apple gets this thing fixed quickly now that they seem to have not given it the attention that I would argue it needs. And speaking of 11.3, I've spoken of it and I've been waiting for it for months because, as we've talked about, I was very disappointed when I think it was the very last version of 10 and then all of the 11s just completely brought my 6S to its knees, my iPhone 6S, because they adopted this ridiculous, you know, oh, we're going to slow your phone down because we're worried that the battery's not strong enough. And of course, I had alleged that, you know, I was taking really good care of my battery and I'm sure it was in good shape. Sure enough, what we have now in 11.3 is that the throttling has been removed until the phone actually experiences a problem with the battery, which seems like the right policy. But there's also a battery health meter. And as I expected, my very old iPhone 6S is 100% health of its battery because I take really good care of my battery. So it was always wrong that Apple – I mean, basically, I got an iPhone 10 out of frustration because they had rendered my iPhone 6S unusable from a software update, which I think is unconscionable. So they got my money, and now I've got an iPhone 6S, which runs just like it used to, just perfectly wonderful, with an even bigger screen than my 10. So anyway, they did fix with 11.3 43 known security vulnerabilities, about half of them in WebKit. So those, it's definitely worth updating. I have maybe 10 iOS devices. I've got two phones and I got pads everywhere. Not a single one of them updated themselves or notified me of an update. It wasn't until I read that 11.3 was available that I then went into the control panel and like, oh yeah, there's my little red one saying you've got a notification. So anyway, now everything's up to date. But for what it's worth, for those who are like me, don't seem to have their devices automatically updating in any timely fashion, because this was pushed out, I think, the middle of last week. You may want to go check. You'll probably find that if you're not at 11.3, your device is willing to go to 11.3. You just got to give it a little bit of a nudge in order to get it unstuck. We have another VPN client IP leak. There's a well-known leakage problem of IP addresses, and we've talked about this for years. The WebRTC function inherently leaks the IP of the client as part of the WebRTC functionality, which is normally not that big a problem because, after all, any site that you're going to knows your IP anyway. But in the case of a VPN user, you are often, as we were discussing last week, wanting your IP to be kept to yourself. That is, you want any site you're visiting to see the IP servers or the IP endpoint IP as a proxy for yours, but not yours. Well, well-designed VPNs have filtered and do filter the WebRTC IP leakage so that doesn't happen. But a researcher, Paolo Stegano, Paolo Stegno, who goes by the handle VoidSec, audited 83 VPN apps, although having looked them over, the definition is a little loose because he's got various non-VPN proxies and things in there too, but 83 things that can put themselves between your browser and you, and most of them are VPNs, 83 of them, to see whether they were properly anonymizing their users by filtering this long-standing WebRTC IP leak. He found that of those 83, 17 VPNs were still leaking their users' IP addresses. And again, the definition here is a little loose for VPN. But I checked, I scanned through the list to see if there were any important ones. Hotspot Shield, which we have spoken of often, does not leak. But, and I remember you chuckling over this one, Leo, when I mentioned it before, Hide My Ass VPN does leak.
Oh,
so
well,
your ass is not as well hidden as the name of the VPN service would suggest. The cool thing is, because he doesn't have the budget or the logistics for checking all VPNs, what he did instead is to create a free service that allows all VPN users to figure out whether their particular VPN is blocking this WebRTC leakage. The site is https://ip.voidsec.com. So ip.voidsec.com. That will just present a nice little page showing you the IP address that you're connecting from. And this, as I was saying before, that's what, you know, any website you go to has an IP from which you are connecting. And by the way, you can do this right now. You don't need, if you're just curious, don't use a VPN. And so you can see what it looks like. You can see if your web browser supports WebRTC, then you go to ip.voidsec.com, you'll probably see a listing of several IPs which are being presented through the WebRTC interface. And then he is maintaining, and Leo, you got it on the screen right now, a Google Doc showing all of the spreadsheets that he has tested and many that other people are reporting yay and nay for, which is how I know that Hide My Ass doesn't. So ip.voidsec.com, if you're a VPN user, absolutely go there. Make sure that the WebRTC interface is not leaking, and if it is, go screaming to your VPN provider, because if you're using Hide My Ass, then we already know that you've got some leakage problem, which really is not what you want. Anyway, so more on the bug bounty front. This time, the federal government. As I've said, as we've been talking about this recently, I think this is a new, career opportunity for people who want to work on their own. And if you're good enough, these bounties are large enough that you can probably support yourself. So recently, as of Sunday, Easter Sunday, April 1st, the DOD, the U.S. Department of Defense, has bellied up to the bar with their own bug bounty program. Well, actually, they're offering a bug bounty program through HackerOne, which is the which is an organization which is sort of the clearinghouse for enterprises that want to offer but have somebody else manage a bug bounty. And I'm going to imagine they probably get a piece of the action. HackerOne is able to count among their customers General Motors, Lufthansa, Starbucks Coffee, the EU, Spotify, Airbnb, Lending Club, Nintendo, WordPress, Twitter, Shopify, Ghostery, Google Play, and Cylance. So, you know, some big players. It's HackerOne.com. Jack Messer, who's the project lead at Defense Manpower Data Center with the DOD, he said the Department of Defense Enterprise System, which I guess is their travel. I saw in some other coverage, it was like their own travel system, their travel agency. So I guess the DOD is naturally, you know, shipping people all over the place. And so they wanted to make sure that their publicly facing travel management system is not leaking too much. So he said, is relied on by millions of employees for global operations. The DOD has seen tremendous success to date working with hackers to secure our vital systems, he wrote, and we're looking forward to taking a page from their playbook. We're excited to be working with the global ethical hacker community and the diverse perspectives they bring to the table. Boy, this guy's a bureaucrat. To continue to secure our critical systems. Okay, so to be eligible to participate in the DOD's bug bounty challenge, individuals from the public must be United States taxpayers or a citizen of or eligible to work in the UK, Canada, Australia, or New Zealand. U.S. government active military members and contractor personnel are also eligible to participate, but not eligible for financial rewards. Okay, so I dug in a little bit looking into the history of this because I was curious. And it turns out that the first instance was 2 years ago with Hack the Pentagon, where over, and this is a little breathtaking, 3,000 vulnerabilities have been resolved since then. The first was Hack the Air Force Bug Bounty Challenge, found 207 valid reports, and hackers earned more than $130,000 for their contributions. The second Hack the Air Force resulted in 106 valid vulnerabilities and $883 paid to hackers. Hack the Army in December of 2016 found 118 valid vulnerabilities and paid out $100,000. Hack the Pentagon in May of 2016 resulted in 138 valid vulnerabilities, which were resolved, and they just wrote tens of thousands paid to ethical hackers for their efforts. And then Hack the Air Force 2.0, which was another round later, demonstrated continued momentum of the Hack the Pentagon program, which is sort of the overall umbrella, beyond just its first year, and further hardened the attack surface. So if there are any listeners who have hacking skills, who like to dig into systems, you want to make sure that you do it ethically, that you're not crossing any lines. But it's very clear to me that this concept of bug bounties, where high profile, well moneyed interests really have to have their products secured, and there's this dawning awareness that their own engineers are not doing the job for whatever reason. And as I've said, I mean, I understand it takes other people to find bugs in things. That's sort of just the nature of the beast. There's a career opportunity here, you know, to make some good money. So something worth considering. Okay. This just seems like a bad idea. There's something called BIMI. And I don't, I guess you would pronounce it BIMI. And it's as in, you know, beam me up. BIMI, brand indicators for message identification. And there's a lot of smoke around this. There's a site, www.brandindicators.org. There's even something called the Auth Indicators Working Group. Okay, so the members of the Auth Indicators Working Group include an outfit called Agari that sort of seems to be spearheading this, Comcast, Google, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Oath as in that Verizon subsidiary that operates AOL and Yahoo, PayPal, ReturnPath, and Valimail, those last two being email providers. And so what this group is trying to do, I'm worried about. They're trying to come up with a way to attach verified logos to email. The site asks the question rhetorically, what if you could put your brand on every email and users could trust it's you? From the site, they say Brand Indicators for Message Identification, BIMI, is an industry-wide standards effort that will use brand logos as indicators to help people avoid fraudulent email.
Oh, this is absurd.
I know. While giving marketers a huge new opportunity to put their brands in front of consumers for free.
Because phishing scam would ever use your logo.
I know.
They wouldn't dare.
I know. And so they say, if you use Yahoo Mail, you will see brand indicator logos from Groupon, Agari, and other large brands in the financial services, aviation, and technology industries. And so just to finish, to explain what they're saying.
Does it show up somewhere beside the email? I mean, like on the side?
The idea would be that, and if you go to the site, Leo, if you go to brandindicators.org, you can see what the way they're proposing. It would be like in the same way that our messages show like the people's faces, like in iMessage, that the idea would be there would be a circle with a company logo next to their email in our inbox. And so they say under brand impression, every time you send an email, you are guaranteed your logo will be displayed in the preview pane and near the from line. Under trusted communications, they say when users see your logo, they'll trust the email and be more likely to respond to your email and do business with you. And then under stop phishing, they said brand indicators will authenticate the sender of the email using an existing standard, DMARC, before displaying your logo. Except, as you immediately picked up on, Leo, none of that is true.
Okay.
So I went over to GitHub.
But wait, it's a win-win situation.
It's a win-win. Authindicators.github.io. And I'm thinking, oh, there's an RFC, there's like a specification, there's all this thing going on. What's it about? So I scroll down after all getting through the boilerplate of how wonderful this is going to be. And under section 3.2 security, it says brand indicators are a potential vector for abuse.
Oh.
Yeah. No kidding. BIMI, B-I-M-I, creates a relationship between sending organization and email receiver so that the receiver can display appropriately designated indicators if the selling domain is verified and has meaningful reputation with the receiver. Without verification and reputation, there is no way to prevent a bad actor, and then give EXXAMPLE.com from using example.com's brand indicators and behaving in a malicious manner.
Well,
yeah,
good.
Exactly,
this really
the
worked.
Problem. And then get this here.
So really, this isn't about verification. This is about putting your logo on the email. Is what this?
Well, yes. And the last line: this document does not cover these verification and reputation mechanisms, but BIMI requires them to control abuse. In other words, we're gonna. Won't this be fabulous to have logos in email that cannot be spoofed? We don't know how to do that, but boy, we got everybody all revved up. And
by the way, if you get an email from me, it will be signed by me, either using an S/MIME cert or a PGP signature that is verifiably mine, and you will know it's me. And that exists and has existed for more than a decade. Oh well,
yeah. The only
doesn't
thing,
have the logo in it, though. That's nice.
No, I saw some reference to them having approached the CAB forum, the CA browser forum, and I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. Imagine if the certificate authorities could sign a logo. In that case, that you could use the same certificate authority system to assert that this logo is associated with this domain. So, you know, maybe, but anyway, none of it's there yet. And unfortunately, this, you know, let's hope none of this happens. I mean, they're already launching this. They're like, oh, they got specs and protocols, and Yahoo email is like doing it now, even though it's completely none of the anti-spoofing protection is there. And of course, the moment that, you know, PayPal shows the PayPal logo in email, it's like, okay, no one can trust that anymore. So bad idea. Bad dog.
I don't know what
they're thinking. Anyway, free electricity. What could possibly go wrong if you have free electricity? Well, cryptocurrency mining might be expected to pop up anywhere you have tech savvy, well, university students who are not paying their own electric bills. And sure enough, it turns out it's becoming a big problem. I got a kick out of an online posting, which was titled, "University Found Out I'm Mining Bitcoin in My Dorm." And the posting reads, "I have free electricity here at ASU, and I decided to use NiceHash to mine some Bitcoin. I've been mining for a month with no problems with a pair of GTX 1080 Ti's, but, you know, some big GPUs. But I just received an email today that I need to uninstall my mining hardware." Yeah, and this person writes, "Now, I'm pretty sure this is not based off my electric bill, as I mined with my laptop for a bit at the same time, and they said I had two devices mining." Meaning they probably saw two connections from his dorm room, two MAC addresses with, you know, mining protocol. He says, "Now I'm wondering how I can get around this problem. Should I use a VPN, or is there another way to disguise my mining? So this was part of a larger story that I got a kick out of that was basically saying that, unfortunately, universities' security is generally not as, you know, not tip top, and that university servers are being besieged with cryptocurrency miners, as we might expect. But there's that problem. And then there's a problem that students who do not have to pay their own electric bill because it's just part of their tuition or whatever. I mean, you know, no one is, you know, your individual room is not typically charged for electricity. They're saying, hey, free electricity. Let's fire up some GPUs and we'll be able to heat the room and get some cryptocurrency at the same time. So, yeah, of course. I imagine we will see universities becoming a little savvy, as apparently this ASU has, and start detecting and probably blocking cryptocurrency mining where possible.
Does it use a known port? I mean, is it, or would you have to do deep packet inspection? Or
yeah, you would need to look at the packets in order to see what was going on. But, you know, I imagine universities are doing some good firewalling anyway, you know, just in order to deal with all of the antics.
Yeah.
You know,
can you imagine? You
know, oh my God, torrents and, yeah. and who knows what. Yeah, it's like, yikes. So, meanwhile, Bleeping Computer reported that Google has announced that effective yesterday, April 2nd, the Chrome Web Store review staff has stopped accepting new extensions, new Chrome browser extensions that perform cryptocurrency mining, and that existing Chrome extensions that perform cryptocurrency mining will be delisted sometime in late June. So it turns out that until yesterday, Google was explicitly allowing deliberately clear mining with Chrome. If the mining extensions, if mining was the extension's sole purpose, so like it was like registered in the Chrome store as a currency miner, and if the user was informed in advance that their computer's resources were going to be used for this the CPU, you know, basically hardware intensive, you know, computer draining task. James Wagner, who's the extensions platform product manager for Google, said that unfortunately, about 90% of all extensions which do mining are attempting to slip that by their user, and they're not complying in one way or another with those policies. So they've, you know, they're not doing user-mediated mining. They're actually doing crypto jacking on the sly. So Google is going to start tracking those things down. And they're not going to accept any more that they can that they know of, and that will allow them, the moment they see that the one got by, to just yank it without by formally changing their policy. And if anyone's wondering, remember that Chrome includes its own task manager under the More Tools menu item that will show the percentage of CPU being consumed per tab. So Chrome breaks it out by tab, and if something is using up a lot of your system, if Chrome itself is like consuming 90% of your system's reserves, you can determine which tab that you've got running is actually doing that. And it may be that you've visited a site that is doing some mining on your browser without your permission. The Under Armour folks who publish MyFitnessPal, a very popular fitness app that has about 150 million users, lost control of their login information. All of their 150 million users' username, email, and hashed passwords were stolen. everyone affected has been notified by email, and there's no information, however, on how the passwords were hashed. They did say that no credit card information or other information appears to have been accessed, since that's stored in a non-breached database. So the protocol is what we've become accustomed to after such breaches. We don't know how strongly protected the hashes were, so we don't know how difficult it will be to reverse the hashes to determine what the passwords were. But certainly, if you are a MyFitnessPal user and you did not get email from them, change your password. And if it happens that you were not using a unique password at MyFitnessPal, you will want to make sure that, because a bad guy could reverse the password potentially and determine what your plain text password was and would have your username and email, they might go poking around trying to see where else they can log in with the same information. So you want to make sure if you've reused that information anywhere else, you get that changed. And after our final break, Leo, we'll talk about some miscellany and then get into our feedback from our listeners and talk about Proton Mail.
Yeah, I can't wait. Should be great. Our show, this portion of our show anyway, brought to you by our great friends at IT Pro TV, Tim and Don. They're coming by, I think, next week. Maybe they'll come by the show. I know a lot of Security Now listeners are IT Pro users. I know that because when we went to the grand opening in Gainesville, virtually everybody said, I mean, literally everybody at the opening, and there were hundreds of people, said, say hi to Steve. Say hi to Steve. Tell Steve we love him. We love Security Now. I figure if you're listening to Security Now, you already love technology. You're already interested in technology. Maybe you already work in IT. Here's a great way to stay up on IT trends, to learn new skills, to get the certs you need to get into IT. There's so many jobs right now in IT. I think I read a million openings in IT security in the United States alone. IT Pro TV prepares you and your team for the most competitive IT certs, from CompTIA to Cisco to AWS. You can learn how to use Kali Linux or Wireshark on IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV has you covered with over 3,300 hours of binge-worthy, on-demand training. And they're always doing live, 125 new live hours every week, far more than we do. They've got 5 studios. They have a chat room going in the back. I mean, it really is a great, you know, exciting, fun, friendly, and smart place to learn all these skills. IT Pro TV's courses can be streamed on a Roku, on an Amazon Fire TV, on an Apple TV, on a PC. They have iOS apps. They have Android apps. Of course, your browser, Chromecast too. You can even download courses for on-the-go learning. We're not talking, you know, your voiceover slides snooze fest. And now, connect to the server using your, not that, no. We're talking engaging, high-quality content. Great for your team. If you have an IT team and you want to keep them well-trained, you can keep them trained without ever leaving the site, right? Plus, with their team portal, you get full control over their schedule. You can track results. You can see metrics. It's great for individuals or for teams. IT Pro TV. Choose a plan, create an account, enjoy the journey. If you'd like to look at the team portal, go to itpro.tv/securitynow, and you can request a free trial. But if you're an individual, and I know lots of you are thinking, I'd like to get a job in IT. Here's the chance to learn 7 days free. itpro.tv/securitynow. itpro.tv/securitynow. And when you do that, use the offer code SN30. And that way, if you do decide to subscribe, you'll get 30% off forever for the lifetime of your active subscription. Now, as an example, they have premium subscriptions, they have regular subscriptions, they have team subscriptions. But the premium subscription, which is a good one, you get the Transcender practice exams, you get virtual labs. So all you need is an HTML5 browser. You could do it on an iPad or a Chromebook. But you can configure Windows Server, Windows Clients. You can do all sorts of stuff in the browser. Windows Server 2019 is coming. You're going to get ready right there. All of that, the exams, the server, the unlimited courses, download courses, $857 a year. which is, I think, a really good price. Even just buying the study materials alone would cost more than that. Certainly a lot less than a technical school. But when you apply the SN30 offer code, $600 a year. That's $50 a month. Unlimited, itpro.tv/securitynow. Unlimited. So try it free for 7 days. SN30 is the offer code, 30% off. Flexible training, binge-worthy content. And, of course, a proven ROI for teams. 90,000 members strong. itpro.tv/securitynow. And use the code SN30. Okay, Steve.
So, Leo, Star Trek Discovery.
Oh, yeah, you binged it.
I did.
Trying to save
Lori
a buck.
Lori and I, we loved it. So I just wanted to follow up for what it's worth. It's on CBS All Access. You can get it for 7 days, free trial, 15 hours, 15 episodes, and absolutely worthwhile. It is, as I mentioned when I talked about it before, it is not Jean-Luc's prime directive federation. It's gritty and sort of adult and really, really good. So I just wanted to follow up and say that we're really happy that we watched the first season, and we'll wait for another season to get done and probably, you know, I would say this time pay for a month in order to watch it over the course of a few nights. It was really good.
Good. That's good to know.
I got one of those really like classic perfect notes from a SpinRite user, Dan Martins, in Fairbanks. And I don't know if there's any Fairbanks other than Alaska. I was just assuming Alaska. But the subject was SpinRite did it again. And he said, "Dear Steve, I'm writing to pass along my mother's ecstatic joy and thanks for what SpinRite did for her. I've been listening to you and Leo for years, and I purchased SpinRite mostly to support you and everything you do for us. I've used it from time to time to check on the drives in my systems, and it may have, I think you right, meant been, helping to keep everything working without any trouble as we know it can. However, my mother's computer did not have SpinRite's maintenance help, and it died without warning. Well, really, there was warning, but she did not know to read the signs. She explained that it had been taking longer and longer to start up in the morning, but she heard the computer slowed down. So she figured that was normal. And naturally, she had not backed up about 3 months' worth of work on the sequel to her first novel. The copy she had on a thumb drive would not read back, and it looked like a complete loss. Since I'm my family's go-to computer tech, she called in a panic and explained that she and her husband had tried everything and they feared the worst. But I knew one thing they had not tried. Her computer has a DVD, so I created and sent her a bootable SpinRite CD. After it arrived, I helped them start SpinRite running and told them to call me back when it was finished. Since I've been listening to you and Leo for years, we all know how this story ends. When she rebooted her computer, everything was back to full speed like it was new. And more importantly, her nearly finished second novel was completely readable."
Oh, wow. That's huge.
Yeah. Yes. "She couldn't believe it, but I knew to expect it. Having had a near-death experience, she will be backing up to multiple drives from now on. So, a happy Easter was had, and thank you hardly seems like enough. Your avid listener and supporter, Dan." So, Dan, wow. Thank you so much. And I'm glad SpinRite was able to come to the rescue. Okay, a little bit of closing the loop. I got a kick out of this one. Doug J. Sent with the subject COBOL. Because remember, what was that? That was the second most dreaded language or something. First was JavaScript, believe it or not, and COBOL was second worst. And so he said, "Hello, Steve. Unfortunately, COBOL is still the old and crumbling foundation for PeopleSoft. I dread it, because he says, once a year, I have to look at it and hope I do not have to make some change, fearing unintended consequences. And I'd heard of people soft before, but I forgot what it was. Well, it turns out that it's one of those things Oracle purchased. PeopleSoft Inc. Was a company that provided human resource management systems, financial management solutions, supply chain management, customer relationship management, you know, all those HRMS, FMS, SCM, and CRM junk that you hear about. Oh, and enterprise performance management software. Perfect. I mean, that's what you want to write in COBOL or those sorts of things, as well as software for manufacturing and student administration to large corporations, governments, and organizations. It was an independent corporation until Oracle purchased it in 2005. So I guess they're going to milk it for whatever revenue it can still generate with its COBOL code. And then maybe just quietly put it out to pasture. Who knows? Anyway, I got a kick out of the fact that my mention last week of COBOL stirred up one of our listeners. And Greg V said his subject was Cloudflare's Quad Ones and privacy. And he asked if DNS UDP traffic passes through your ISP unencrypted, how can it be private? Isn't it a simple task for the ISP to track the queries? And he signed off, SpinRite owner Greg. And of course, as we know, yes, as long as you're using UDP, no privacy, no authentication, man-in-the-middleable, and subject to all kinds of exploitation. Where we are headed, however, at least initially with our browsers, will be to establish. I imagine when we launch the browser will come up and reach out to its pre-configured DNS over TLS provider, like Cloudflare or like Google, bring up a tunnel, and then all of the browser's DNS resolution will then go through that tunnel. In order to give us all the benefits of security and authentication, and the benefit, for example, in the case of Cloudflare, of extremely good performance. So for now, we don't have that yet. Quad One from Cloudflare over UDP gives us very good speed. And of course, as I covered before, you can use GRC's benchmark to find out how it compares. And by the way, I didn't say, I would love to hear back from our listeners what other people find using the benchmark. I will I'll be happy to share that with our broader listener base if people want to send me or tweet their results from running the GRC benchmark, having added 1.1.1.1 and 1.0.0.1, and then do the benchmark. And finally, Scott T. on the East Coast. His subject was secure email / transition away from Gmail. He says, I'm looking to move away from Google Mail and was wondering what options you recommend besides spinning up one's own server. Or if you do recommend spinning up your own server, what's the best way to make it as maintenance-free as possible?
If you have to ask, and do not.
Yes, Leo. Yeah, thank you. Perfect.
I recommend Fastmail? Fastmail.com is awesome.
Yes. Yes.
They are very active in the IMAP community. It's the best IMAP implementation I've ever run into. Lots of nice features. It's not free. But I took my email off of Gmail and I use Fastmail entirely. I used to use Gmail for spam filtering, but I don't even feel I need that anymore. They have very good Civ spam filtering. So highly recommend Fastmail.com. They're really good. Nice. But I'm going to listen to what you say about Proton Mail.
Well, so yes. So Fastmail.com number, it's absolutely something to consider. And I was hoping you were going to chime in and tell us who your provider was.
Yeah, I love them. Love them.
So Proton Mail has been sort of floating around. It was, first of all, I get the feeling across the board that the founders' hearts are in the right place. It is a to I would say to every degree possible encrypted email service. It was founded 4 years ago in 2014 by some guys at CERN, the well-known research facility in Switzerland. On the desktop, Proton Mail offers web browser JavaScript-driven client-side encryption. So so it's browser-based on the desktop, and there's JavaScript running there, which performs encryption of the contents in a way that they don't get the key. So this is essentially TNO email service. Trust no one email. But of course, doing this is not simple because you still need to be able to transact email with other people, with other Proton Mail users and so forth. So let me sort of get into some of these details. It's also worth noting that they offer iOS and Android apps, and it was a recent, like last week, update in their mobile offerings that brought them back onto my radar. They on the website, they are also, since November of last year, they've been encrypting the user's contacts. So the user's key that they don't have is used to encrypt and store the user's contacts on their server. Last week, that feature was added to Proton Mail's iOS and Android apps, so that's available for the first time there as well. So Proton Mail is operated by Proton Technologies AG, which is a company based in Geneva, with servers in two locations in Switzerland, which of course places them both sets of servers outside of the U.S. and EU jurisdiction, which may be important for some users. The default account setup is free, and the service is sustained by optional paid or just voluntarily. You can pay for services, or you can just give them, send them some money to support them. And it's been a success. As of a year ago, January 2017, they had over 2 million users. It was initially a crowdfunded startup. I think it was Indiegogo that launched them like 4 years ago, and they were looking for $100,000, and they instantly got $500,000 and some odd dollars. So, it was clearly something that was interesting a lot of users. So they explain on their site, under anonymous email and protecting their users' privacy, they said no personal information is required to create your secure email account. By default, they write, we do not keep any IP logs which can be linked to your anonymous email account. Your privacy comes first. Under open source, free secure email, they say, we believe email privacy should be available to all. That's why our code is open source, and basic Proton Mail accounts are always free. You can support the project by donating or upgrading to a paid account. And easy to use / security without the hassle. Proton Mail can be used on any device without software install, meaning, web-based. Proton Mail secure email accounts are fully compatible with other email providers. You can send and receive emails normally. Now here's where it gets interesting, because they've done a lot. And I did get a kick out of, as I mentioned at the top of the show, under physical security, that they mention Proton Mail's infrastructure resides in Europe's most secure data center underneath 1,000 meters of solid rock. So, okay. But what matters to us, of course, is the technology. So Proton Mail uses a combination of public key crypto and symmetric encryption protocols to offer end-to-end encryption. When a user creates a Proton Mail account, their browser generates a public key pair. So, of course, that's a public key and its matching private key, and those are RSA keys. It'd be nice, maybe at some point they will evolve to elliptic curve keys, since that would make them much smaller and handier. But for now, RSA keys, and actually they're 4096 bit RSA keys, so they're not messing around. The public key is used to encrypt the user's emails and other user data. The private key, capable of decrypting the user's data, is symmetrically encrypted with the user's mailbox password. This symmetric encryption happens in the user's browser using AES 256. So as good an encryption algorithm as there is. Upon account registration, the user is asked to provide a login password for their account, and Proton Mail also offers users to log in with two-password mode that requires a login password and a mailbox password. The login password in that case is used for authentication. The mailbox password encrypts the user's mailbox that contains received emails, contacts, and user information, as well as that private encryption key. So that allows them to store the key for you. But then, for example, if you went to a browser where you hadn't been before and you wanted to have full access, you would use both of these authentications. The second one, doing a local decryption of your matching private key, so they never have it, but you're able to essentially retrieve it in encrypted form from them. Then they say upon logging in, the user has to provide both passwords. This is to access the account and the encrypted mailbox and its private encryption key. The decryption takes place client-side, either in a web browser or in one of the mobile apps. The public key and the encrypted private key are both stored on Proton Mail servers. Thus, Proton Mail stores decryption keys only in their encrypted form. So Proton Mail developers are, that is, you know, the Proton Mail people, are unable to retrieve user emails nor reset user mailbox passwords. So again, this is, you know, with true security comes responsibility. It is TNO. It is trust no one. So, you know, they can't perform recovery for you. You've got to make sure you store these things safely. And so this system, as they wrote it, absolves Proton Mail from storing either the unencrypted data or the mailbox password, divulging the contents of past emails, and decrypting the mailbox if requested or compelled by a court order. In other words, they can't do any of that. They don't have the keys. Proton Mail exclusively supports HTTPS and uses TLS, and they've got a great TLS, an ephemeral key exchange to encrypt all internet traffic between users and the Proton Mail servers, 4096-bit RSA SSL certificate was signed by Quovatis TrustLink and supports extended validation, certificate transparency, public key pinning, and strict transport security. So, you know, they did all of the right things, checked all the boxes. In fact, they hold an A-plus rating from Ivan Ristic's Qualys SSL Labs for their servers. Then, a couple years ago, they added native support to the web interface and their mobile apps for PGP. So they support pretty good privacy. This allows a user to export their ProtonMail PGP encoded public key to others outside of ProtonMail, enabling them to use the key for encryption, you know, for mail coming back to those users. And they said that the ProtonMail team plans to support PGP encryption from ProtonMail to outside users. And then the last bit of coolness that I got a kick out of, because again, you know, it's you've got security between your client and them. What about outbound from them? And that's, of course, the bugaboo with email, unless you know that your intended destination is a PGP user. So they said an email sent from one ProtonMail account to another is automatically encrypted with the public key of the recipient. Remember, they have the public keys. They don't have the private keys. And that's cool because that allows them. And so any email incoming is immediately encrypted with the recipient's public key, and they can't decrypt it from that point. And inter-ProtonMail traffic never leaves their servers, and essentially it comes from the user, and it's immediately encrypted with using the public key of its ProtonMail recipient, and then waits there for that recipient to pick it up. So, for example, it would be easy if you wanted to set up a little network among a group to all use a free ProtonMail account, and all of your email stays on their servers and is always kept encrypted, and only the recipient is able to decrypt it after it's been transferred into their inbox. They say once encrypted, only the private key of the recipient can decrypt the email. When the recipient logs in, their mailbox password decrypts their private key to unlock their inbox. And now, email sent from ProtonMail to non-ProtonMail email addresses may optionally be sent in plain text or with end-to-end encryption. With encryption, the email is encrypted with AES under a user-supplied password. The recipient receives a link to the ProtonMail website on which they can enter the password and read the decrypted email. ProtonMail assumes that the sender and the recipient will have previously exchanged this password through a back channel. Such emails can be set to self-destruct after a period of time. So that's a really cool solution for wanting to encrypt something to somebody who doesn't themselves, who is not tech savvy, doesn't support, you know, doesn't know how to do PGP or perform their own decryption. So the idea would be you would come up with a password, get it to them through some other channel, you know, fax it to them, carefully dictate it over the phone, whatever, so that they have that. You then are able to send them email, which you encrypt with that password. What they get is a web link, a clickable link that takes them back to ProtonMail over HTTPS with TLS, and so pure complete security, and they enter the password, which on their browser performs symmetric decryption so that even ProtonMail never sees the decrypted email. It's decrypted on the recipient's browser so that they're then able to receive the mail. So, you know, as I said, they thought through essentially every possible scenario and to extend the email encryption envelope as far as possible. And I just, you know, given that technology is open source, is auditable, clearly these guys have their hearts in the right places. They don't want to be able to respond to court orders, and they've designed a system whereby they can't. You as the user need to make sure you don't lose your passwords, because inherently they are unable to provide them to you. But in return for that, you get a very nice trust no one free or optionally paid or donation supported email system based in Switzerland that does allow you to get encrypted contents to people who otherwise don't know how to do anything with encryption, with the obligation being to somehow get the decryption password to them so that you're then able to exchange mail. So a very cool solution, and one worth looking at if somebody wants to move away from Gmail. And of course, Leo, yours, Fastmail, is just a straightforward email system.
It's not encrypted.
If somebody doesn't want all of that, all that rigmarole.
It's sad that, I understand why, but that GNU Privacy Guard or PGP never really caught on, because it solves the problem. It doesn't solve the metadata problem, but solves the problem of encrypted email, trust no one, and all of that stuff. But it's too hard for people to use. And just nobody uses it. S/MIME certificates are easier, but nobody uses that either.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I was talking with Padre on KnowHow last week, and we talked about that. It's the way I look at it is the only reason we have moved from that land where FireSheep was able to acquire people's browser sessions and impersonate them is that it was all done for the end user. That is, users don't have to do anything with encryption. All they do is like, oh, look, I have a padlock now, or my key's not broken any longer. You know what I mean? You know, or, oh, look, the URL is in green. I guess that's good. Green means good. The point is that it was servers that did this and browsers that did this. End users had to do nothing. And even getting websites to do it was like pulling teeth. We had to make it free so that it didn't cost anything. And it was all automatic. And you just like hook up and, oh, look, your server automatically does let's encrypt and off you go. I mean, what we've seen is that we have to drop the bar so low in order to get people to do anything more that finally we've got that with HTTPS. So, you know, that suggests that there's just no way that was going to happen with email unless it was just automatically somehow magically done and no one had to like lift a finger. And, you know, that just, you know, so what we ended up with is where it was important, people have, you know, the tools are there to do it and to make it pretty easy.
Measure of how people don't really, as long as people
don't
understand,
really care.
They don't really care. This is a postcard. They don't seem to really care. The real issue is the key exchange is the difficult thing. And that's something, by the way, PGP has solved beautifully. There are these public key servers. Any PGP or GNU Privacy Guard implementation will have a lookup feature that looks it up on the servers, an ability to post yourself on the servers. So there's a directory. If people want to have my PGP key, for instance, they could search for my email address or my name on the servers, download it, and add me. And it's very simple. I mean, it's a system that really works. And I really think that's the problem. It's just nobody really cares.
Yeah.
Yeah. The nice thing about that is, Proton Mail is not impervious to a warrant from the Swiss authorities. And with the Cloud Act, it's probably not impervious to U.S. authorities either in the long run. But PGP, only you have the key. They'd have to come to you and say, unlock it. And at least you'd know.
True. True.
At least you'd know. I'm glad ProtonMail exists. And I've had an account since 2014. I mean, I signed up early on.
Well, and for what it's worth, remember, between PGP users, between ProtonMail users, it's the same. I mean, it's encrypting before it leaves the browser and decrypting only when it is received by the other end.
Right.
So ProtonMail does offer the same end-to-end encryption and no attack on their servers legally or physically can reveal the contents.
The a Gmail to Gmail email is encrypted in place and in flight, only Gmail to Gmail. And it's unclear whether Google has access to the mail. I think they do because they have anti-spam tools. So
well, and Gmail is only encrypted over HTTPS in flight.
That's right.
So it's 128 instead of bit. Using instead of using a local private key.
Right. Right. So, I have I use a 4096 bit key in my PGP, but I mean I don't. It's not. There's no point. And I don't have. I mean, I you know.
Yeah. In fact, even Padre, who like you has been a PGP. You know, user from the beginning. He said, I think maybe I've maybe three people.
Yeah, I have a long list of names in my key list, but the entire conversation I've ever had with any of these is this set up correctly? Yes, it is. And that's
Hello,
it.
Hello, can you hear me?
It works.
Yes, I hear you.
And
okay.
I do every, you know, month I get a couple of emails from people saying, well, you're the only one I know who uses it, so is it working? And I'll respond and encrypt it if I can back to them, and that's about it. I had one guy, and he stopped. Used to send me news articles encrypted, which you know, like suggestions for stories to cover, which was fine. I mean,
And I said when I was talking to Padre, he's like, you know, if you know, I mean, I just have no need for it. I've never bothered. Right. If I ever needed to send something encrypted, I would write it in Word. I would encrypt it myself.
Right. You'd use MiniLock or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And then attach it to an email and say, here, you know, here's a blob. Decrypt it using our prearranged solution.
So, I've had my MiniLock key on my website for several years, and I've never received anything. But because you know, what are you going to send me? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, there is a very clever password manager that uses PGP to it actually is I think extreme it's if I were going to design a personal but you have to maintain it does a folder tree of all your passwords in PGP encrypted and then you I guess it must have a clear name so that leaks a little bit but only locally it's called Pass if anybody wants to look at it. It's the only application I know of. And then there's Keybase, which I use, and that's another way people can keep track of your key.
Yep.
I do sign my mail, and I think that that's important. I think that that is, back to this Beamy story, if people might impersonate me, I do think it's good that if you get an email, people impersonate me all the time. If you get an email from me and it's not signed, not to trust it.
Yep.
Steve Gibson's at grc.com. That's the Gibson Research Corporation. And you know what you'll find there? Many, many things. First and foremost, of course, SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility.
Every week
we hear another great story about SpinRite. You'll also find Squirrel, Perfect Paper Passwords, Shields Up, the DNS.
That DNS benchmark.
Yep. Wow, must have. Inspector, still relevant. Lots of stuff. That's all free because Steve does it all out of the goodness of his heart, including this show, which you can find there. He has audio and very nicely crafted, handwritten, well, I'm sure she types, but human-written transcripts. That's using her hands. Elaine Ferris does those each week. It takes a few days to get them out, but that's a great way to search the site for stuff and it's a really nice thing to have. We also have audio and video on our website, twit.tv/SN. In fact, if you're there, subscribe. You might as well get every episode. You want to have the collection. Get all 657. It's a wonderful thing to have. And you can watch it, too, if you have a hankering to see how Steve does his Vulcan sign-off there. And what else? Have I said everything? Oh, we do it every Tuesday at 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC if you want to watch live at twit.tv/live and join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv.
Yay.
Yay. Thank you, Steve. We'll see you next time on Security Now.
Okay, buddy. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Security Now.